How many of you feel like you're involved in a society? Okay. No? Okay, right. Go on there. Fantastic. Well, I think that USA looks at involvement in the wrong way. It says that students are involved or they're not involved. Either they're an elected rep or they're not. Now, I think involvement comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes. Whether that's being involved in a society, maybe signing a petition about an issue you care about, or engaging with an issue on Facebook. I think that that's involvement, and that's making a difference in the way that your university experience. And I think USA needs to be recognising that our power comes from the 27,000 students who make up our membership, while the student council in our relationship with university members. And so I think by showing students support for ideas, we can achieve so much more. Things like career fair with the jobs that you want, not just arms companies you can. And exam dates published earlier, so that people get cheaper. So that's me. I'm Hugh Merlin, I'm a person. If you like what I'm saying, please vote for me next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll be really brief as well. My name is Josh Jones, and I'm standing to be the Vice President of Services. That's the person that runs all the use of bars and venues. So I've been chatting to people over the last couple of weeks, asking them how they improve Tevia or Potter Row or KB House or Pleasance. And the one thing that comes up again and again and again is prices. Now, I think there's a really easy way that we can reduce the prices in those venues, and that's to offer more drinks promotions and more special deals. At the moment, whenever I open the menu in TV, I just think, God, these prices are just the same. They're always the same. I never think this is a good deal. I always just think, okay, we're standard. I think we need to change that. I think we need to make the menu a lot more dynamic. Similarly, I want to change the way that we look at entertainment within our venues. At the moment, the only thing that's really on offer is the big cheese. And while some may like it, others don't at all. I want to allow students to run their own club nights at our venues. So whatever the type of music or the type of night you want to put on, you can do it and USA will support you. So that's kind of what my campaign's about. It's about saying that we are customers, but we're also members of USA, and therefore we should be the active decision makers in terms of the running of our unions. And if you agree with me, then you should vote for me, Josh Jones, for Vice President of Services.
I have a good question.
Yeah, go for it.
Like five other guys said the same thing, but what stopped the other 10 guys in the last 10 years to do the same thing?
Well, a lot of other people seem to promise just cheaper drinks. Blanket cheap drinks. I don't think that's sustainable at all. I don't think it would be kind of right for me to stand here and go, cheaper drinks, that's what's going to happen. But I think that this is actually an opportunity to, in many ways, it's more profitable. Because we're actually saying that on this night, we'll have a big night where the drinks are cheaper and you can come in, and it's actually incentivizing for people to spend more time. I want to change the attitude that Tevia and Potter or whatever are just convenient places. I want to actually make them places where we want to go. Does that kind of answer your question already? Yeah. Alright, thanks a lot. Anyway,
thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
10 seconds.
Okay, yeah.
So, my name is Andrew Barney. You've probably had emails from me. I'm currently one of your two score reps along with Kolos. I'm the guy who started the petition that made sure that next year, when you have up to 11 exams, if you take logic programming, you will have 4 weeks for those. That's assuming the university will go back on their promises this year. If you vote Andrew Barney for Vice President Academic Affairs on my end next week, I will hold them to account as I have this year. You will have the full 4 weeks for your exams. Thanks a lot, guys. Enjoy your lecture.
Thank you. Thank you. Right. Well. Okay. Welcome again. Yes. Well, it's well underway, and I would hope that we're done within the allocated period, which is, I think, a month after the submission. So I think we're about, what, 2-3 weeks in now, eh? Yes, so I'll check with the TA, but I know he started quite early on, but it's quite a lot of marking. But yeah, thank you. I'll check with him and see how he's getting on. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Because I asked him to make sure that he writes some feedback on things as well, so yeah, it's taking longer. Okay, so welcome to the dedicated few. Must be some kind of deadline on tomorrow. I can't think of what that might be, but anyway. We're going to start our final topic for this thread of the course today. And as with the other major topics, obviously it's going to be essentially an introduction. We're not going to cover a huge amount of it, but enough to give you an idea of what's involved and some starts towards a solution. Okay. So our concern here is, how do you cope with vast amounts of data? You know, really huge amounts of data. So if you in Google, a search for a full stop, Okay, don't ask me why you do that. I just thought, what will it do? Well, here's how much it returns. You can see there, okay? And that's just for one search on one thing. You could do a search for news, and you get an equally vast thing, and then you do a search for A, and it gets vast things. And that's just three different things you could search for. And it's got to cover all the possible things that are out there, okay? So we're talking about really vast amounts of data, okay? So you're not going to keep that kind of amount of data in main memory on a computer. You've got to cope with it through secondary storage. And your algorithms have to be able to cope with that, not as we have been doing so far, assuming that we can fit everything into main memory, okay? All right, so that's the practical bit done, okay? All right, let's just start with our setup. So we're going to assume we have a large set D of documents, maybe web pages. We could be using large databases as our example. It doesn't matter, just any kind of concept of there's stuff out there in discrete objects which contain information and you want to somehow categorize that information. Okay, so obviously web pages are a very good example to use. But I don't want you to have the idea that, you know, this application starts just with the web. You can apply it to all sorts of things. Databases obviously go back much longer than the web. Okay. We have a set of terms which appear in the documents. And the set of terms is usually called the lexicon from the Greek for dictionary. Okay. And an inverted file entry then consists of a single term followed by a list of the locations where the term appears. So, and how much information you give depends on your application. So it may be just as much as this term appears in this document, that document, etc. Or it might be more refined information. Okay. So some information of some kind for a term. So one entry consists of a term, or as we move to a term number, we will replace terms by numbers because they are quicker to process, less memory, and so on. And then information on that term. Okay. An inverted index then is a set of inverted file entries, one for each of the terms in the lexicon, and presented in increasing order of term number. Okay, as I say, we usually associate a number with each term. If you think about it, if you use strings, if you say, take the English language, look at how many possible strings there are of length 6. It's a huge number. Now, how many English words of length 6 are there? Relatively very few, because most sequences are not a word, okay? So you save space by going to integer representations. And you hold some kind of association. This is the term number for this word, this is the term number for that, and so on, okay? All right. So here's a toy example. Obviously, this is very much a toy example. So let's suppose that our document consists of a set of lines, 6 lines. So each line is a document, a very small size document, obviously, okay? In which case, we might number this as document 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 6. And then our set of terms that we might search for will be all the words in there. And we want to hold information on, you know, given this word, where does it occur? So the word cold, for example, appears in documents 1 and 4, line 1 and line 4. Okay, and this is a frequency count, in our case, just how many documents. It so happens that each word occurs in 2 documents. Not the count of how many times, but how many documents in this case. You might decide to count how many times in total. That's just a matter of, you know, for the application that you have in mind. Okay, I don't want to give you the idea that this is some kind of fixed moral order, that this is always what you do, but you always want to hold some information about each term of certain kind, and here's a kind of compressed way of doing it. You might hold it in other ways, it doesn't really matter, okay? But this is fairly typical, okay? We might decide to hold more refined information, so for the same example, we might decide to hold not only the document, but where in the document, okay? So, again, term 1 occurs in document 1, and it's the 6th word in that document. And also in document 4, and it is the 8th word in that document, and so on, okay? For example, term 6, the word like occurs in document 4 in positions 2 and 6, okay? Whether you want to hold the information, that granularity is a matter for what you're going to do with this information, okay? But it's always term information about the term. Okay. All right. So our inverted index then is a set of all words that appear in the What is our lexicon? How do we define it? Well, it could be the set of all words that appear in all possible documents, okay? Or it might be a predefined set of given keywords for which you search. If you submit a paper for publication to a scientific journal, they ask you to assign keywords to your paper, okay? From fairly standard types of keywords. But you have a choice of so many keywords that you can assign to it, so that anybody searching for your paper, if they enter these well-known keywords, and it so happens that your paper is relevant, it'll come up. Okay. So which approach you take would depend on the intended application, obviously. But option one is the most common in that, you know, if the word occurs anywhere in your documents, then it should be recorded that it occurs. If you go for the restricted keywords option, you're saying basically, the people wanting to use this information know that we're only talking about these limited concepts, and they just want to find the documents that refer to those limited concepts. Perfectly okay, you know, it's a matter of application, okay? But again, if we say all words, it can be a little bit misleading in that when you parse documents, you tend to want to remove words which are going to occur in every document, words like and, or, and so on. Depending on the application at hand, you might want to say, no, I'm not going to bother holding information on those. Such words are called stop words. You know, they're basically words which you ignore. Okay? And my searches at Google were an attempt to find out if Google has any stop words. And I didn't find any. I mean, you know, even the full stop gives you entries. Comma gives you entries. The word the gives you entries. The letter A gives you entries. As far as I can see, they will just index everything. But in some other application, you may not want to hold all such words. Again, there's no moral law that says this is a stop word, this is not. What is a stop word and what is not is determined by your intended application. We want to perform case folding, usually. That's to say, we don't want to take account of whether it's uppercase or lowercase. We just map everything to say lowercase and regard it as being the same, whether it occurs with an uppercase letter or not. Fairly typical thing to do, okay? And also stemming, this is of course the fact that if you're dealing with natural language, then words change according to their grammatical function. So see and seeing, although they are, if you like, strictly speaking, two different words, there is a sense in which they are the same word. One is derived from the other. And of course, you know, with other, common with many languages that you have declensions and the like, so you don't want to regard a word as being different just because it's been used in a grammatically different way. It's the same word. Okay. So again, how much of this you do, it depends on the intended application, but it's a fairly common thing to do these three things. Okay. I'm not going to go into details on this. This is really a matter for text processing. Just mentioning that these are issues that one would obviously take account of when making these applications. And now, granularity of index just refers to just how much information you do want to hold on each entry. Is it just document level, it occurs in this document, or is it occurs in exactly this position in this document, or maybe even more refined information? Again, that's just a matter of intended application rather than any kind of, you know, once and for all law that says it must be this or it must be that. Okay. So the first index of our toy example was only document level granularity. And this is, if you like, the kind of default situation. Because if you're dealing with vast numbers of documents, going to any further level, then you're just going to be swamped with so much information that you can't cope with it at all. But if you're dealing with more moderate-sized documents, it may be okay. And the second index went to the word-level granularity, okay, which is really quite a fine level of granularity, if you think about it. Okay. And of course, the level of granularity affects the level of precision of information you get, not surprising. Okay, as I mentioned, each term has a term number that we assign. We can assign them in any way we like, as long as we maintain a record that, you know, the term number for this word is one, the term number for this word is two, etc. it's up to us. We have to maintain some kind of record, and you can imagine that's quite easy to do. Okay. Now, just to avoid the confusion, although I'm talking about vast amounts of data, the number of terms themselves is not going to be so enormous. You know, if you say dealing with the English language, you can certainly hold all the English language words in a computer. That's not a big problem in the big computer, but you can do it. Okay. It's the accumulated information about all those terms that is vast. Okay. You know, when we saw the Google search for the word news, it's only one word, right? But the amount of information there was just absolutely unbelievable. Okay. If we want to have, if we have this inverted index now that holds information about terms and where they occur in documents, then a query might consist of a single term. So in our example, say the word peas. Okay. And then it's just a matter of you just find the entry for that single term, or it might involve a combination in the familiar style that I'm sure you've seen lots of, you know, so-called advanced search. It doesn't seem very advanced to me, but, you know, advertising has its uses, I guess, where you might form Boolean combinations. So you might say peas and cold, or peas or cold, and so on. And then, of course, you don't have to create your index. You use the index for peas, use the index for cold, and if it's and, you take the intersection of the entries. So you find documents where it occurs in both, you know, in the same document, both words occur in the same document. If it's an or, you form the union of entries, one or the other. So that's quite simple to do, and we shan't look at this in any further detail. Okay, so those matters are very straightforward. Okay. Our concern is how to build such an index. Now, there's an obvious method for building such an index, which we'll first go with, and then we'll observe its limitations. Okay, so let's do that first. So let's assume we can work entirely in memory, as we have done so far in the course. Okay. Then we can use a dictionary data structure to store items of the form term and then list of information about that term. As we come across a term, we update the list. Okay. And we might use, say, an AVL tree for holding this information, because AVL trees have fast insertion, fast deletion, fast lookup. Okay, so there's everything going for them. So why not? Okay. So in phase one, we consider each document D, parsing it for terms. Okay. As we come across a term, we look it up in the dictionary. If it's not there, we create a new entry. If it is there, we amend the entry. Okay, so simple enough. Okay. And now, having parsed all the documents, we now have our dictionary held as an AVL tree. We can now read off each term with its information and write it out to our index file or whatever we want to hold it in order of term number. So lowest term first, second term, etc., etc. So very simple algorithm, and here it is in all its glory. I mean, you know, basically that's just pseudocode for the simple thing I've just said. So no point in my going through it in detail. It just writes down in pseudocode exactly what we've just discussed. Okay. All right. If we wanted to analyze the runtime, we'd have to take care of these different phases, as it says on here. The point is this, though. For our situation, asymptotic analysis is not quite the point, okay? Because we are struggling to actually manage the data. Yes, asymptotic analysis, we do that because we say, if you double the amount of data, what will happen to your runtime? Will it double, quadruple, or what? Okay. Here, we don't want to think about doubling the amount of data. We can only just about hold it, you know. Okay. So it's not that it's irrelevant, but it's not quite the most important point. Okay. Of course, you want to make each part of this process fast, right? But in terms of the overall performance, your concern is, can I do it at all, right? And if I can do it at all, then what's the fastest I can manage with each bit of it, okay? So this is our scenario. We want to pack as many documents as possible into memory, because if you can pack things into main memory, you can process them much faster than if you've got to keep going to secondary memory, fetching stuff, writing out, and so on, okay? That's really our main kind of design aim. Okay. So given that we're now becoming more realistic and saying, well, look, okay, we pretended we could hold everything in main memory, but actually we know we can't, that algorithm was just a way to get us off the ground and say, okay, now can we take care of the obvious problems with it? What's the obvious problem with it? It was that we assumed we could hold this information all in main memory. I mean, parsing a document in main memory is obviously not a problem. You just do it sequentially, just read, parse, etc. Okay, but holding all the accumulated data is clearly the problem. Okay, and then examining the entire tree to write out the data. Okay, and if we tried to hold our AVL tree on disk, I mean, we can do. Okay, that's not a problem. You can hold it on disk, of course, right? But then when you try and use it, your performance is just going to become so dire, you know. It doesn't matter whether it's an optimal data structure or not, because whatever you do, you're going to be writing out the vertices of the tree. They're going to be all over the place. And when you're trying to get them in order, the head of the disk is going to go to one place, then somewhere vast away, and then back, and then whatever. So trying to find where the data is in order is just hopeless. Okay? If it's in main memory, then you just have a point, and you go to, you know, to that, to that, to that. There's no moving of any physical kind, so it's not a problem in main memory. But if it's going to be moving an actual head of a disk, that is a real problem. Okay, so this is not a real realistic way of addressing our problem. Using an AVL tree held on main disk is just not on. Okay, so we've got to find the better way. Okay, and our alternative is going to be to go back to our old friend merge sort, which looked like not a terribly good candidate when you're thinking about sorting stuff entirely in main memory. You remember merge sort uses the auxiliary array for merging partially sorted subarrays into bigger subarrays and so on. And then you copy this back and it looks like that's, you know, it's a real downer in terms of performance, because you have to keep copying back and forward, okay? This now becomes a strength, okay, as we shall see. Okay, the main thing we have to bear in mind is we want to minimize non-sequential accesses to disk, okay? And you actually want to minimize the number of times you go to disk. You know, if you read 10 items in one go, compare the time with reading those 10 items in go 1, go 2, go 3, go 4, etc. It's much slower to do them individually. You know, you read it and then you think about it and you say, oh, read the next one, think about it, and then, oh, the next one, because there's latency in the head movement, okay? But if you do it in one go, it just locates the block and reads sequentially, okay? So we want to minimize that kind of breaking up of the access to disk. Now, actually, I'm going to bypass this design feature of merge sort just now, and I'll come back to it and discuss this algorithm in detail with you, okay? So let me bypass this slide, okay, and go, let's assume we've done our external merge sort, okay? We've got it implemented, so it can handle merging vast amounts of data held on some external disk, okay? How would we use it? Well, it's now a simple matter, okay? We create our dictionary data structure S. This is going to hold the terms and their term numbers, remember, not the data itself, okay? So that's okay, right? And now we create an empty file on disk, call it temp file, okay? This is going to hold the information, which is absolutely so vast that we can't hold it in main memory. Okay? Now we parse the documents one after the other. We take a document, parse it into index terms. For each index term, a T in our document, current document, DI, we let FTD be the information that we've recovered from this one document, remember, okay? The current document, not across all documents, just the current one, okay? Check if T is already in S, have we seen this term before? And if we have, recover its term number. If we haven't seen it before, enter it into the dictionary and give it the next available term number and update your term number counter so next time you give next term a different number, okay? And now write the information you've just recovered about this term on this document out to temp file. Okay. You just write it out, appending. When you finish parsing all your documents now, you've got all the information you've recovered about every single term in every single document written out to disk, but of course it's all over the place. Term one might have an entry, so you might have an entry here for term one with the information, here an entry for term 100 with the information, and somewhere way over here there's an entry for term one with some information, and somewhere way over here there's an entry for term 100 with some information, etc. It could be all over the place because we just recovered it document after document appending to the end of the file as we get our information. Okay, so we now have to glue all this stuff together. Okay, well, if we sort this information by term number, okay, then we're going to end up with it in a much more usable form. We're going to get, let's say one is the smallest term number. You're going to get entry term one with information, term one with information, up to some term one with information, and then let's say term three with information, etc. Okay. So now gluing this information together is very easy. You just sequentially access from the disk while you're seeing term one, pull it into main memory, conjoin the information that you've just pulled with the information so far. When you've conjoined that, now write it back out. So that's obviously not a problem. Okay. And you know when you finish because you see a different term number. Okay. So if we can sort this stuff, we are in fine shape. Okay. And this conjoining information is very efficient, as efficient as we can hope for, in that the access is entirely sequential. You just keep accessing until you don't need to access anymore. You pause, you process everything, you write out, and now you carry on, pause, etc. Okay, so you can't really ask for better. Okay. My apologies. Okay, so now let's go back to our algorithm for merge sort. Okay, that's the pseudocode. I'm not going to bother with that at all. It's in the notes. Okay, don't get freaked out by it. It's nothing more or less than what I'm about to describe. It's a very simple idea, very beautiful idea. So let's do that. For some reason, many students find this algorithm difficult to understand, and I have to say I find that difficult to understand. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay, so let me try and make it as natural as I can for you. Okay, of course you may be amongst a small set who don't find it difficult to understand. In which case, well, we'll just have a bit of fun and then we'll go home. Okay, and have a coffee. Yeah. All right. So what's the idea? We've got this vast file, okay, on disk. Okay. Let's just think just about term. Obviously, the information is just carried along. Just think about term numbers alone. Okay. So let's just think about sorting integers, right? It's exactly that we're doing. The information corresponding to term number just gets carried along. Okay. All right. Now, our problem is that this is so huge, you can't put it all into main memory in one go and sort it by your favorite sorting algorithm. All right? So you could revisit merge sort and say, okay, merge sort, I know we started top down. We said start with the array, cut it in half, assume you merge the two halves and now glue them together. Right? But we could have done it bottom up. We could have said, look, because if you think about how the recursion bottoms out, when it gets to arrays of size 1, it says, oh, these are sorted, right? And it says, oh, let me glue arrays of size 1 together. Okay, that gets you arrays of size 2. Oh, those are sorted. Now take arrays of size 2, glue them together, get arrays of size 4, etc., right? So let's do it bottom up. So we've got our file here. These are individual entries, okay? That's sorted. So I pull them into main memory. This is not a terribly good idea, but bear with me. We'll repair it. Okay. I'm trying to illustrate how can you design an algorithm by saying, let me not worry too much about every single problem. Let me just try and find some way of doing it and then repair anything that's not quite right. Okay. So one way of sorting this would be pull that into main memory. Sorry. Oh. I need some water, I think. Okay. Sort them and now write it out as a size 2 block, which is sorted, right? Now go to the next two, do the same. You get the idea. Okay? When you've done that, now switch. This is your input disk, this is your output disk. Okay? And what do? Well, I'm sure you've already guessed it. Pull this sorted block into main memory, pull this sorted block into main memory, zip them together so they are sorted. Okay? And when you've done that, write it out to to here, and now you get this entire. So you've doubled the size of the block that's sorted. Okay. We have to worry that, you know, we may get the odd size block at the end left over because there isn't exactly the right number of blocks to pair them up, but we can take care of that just, you know, quite easily. Let's not worry about that, okay? Yeah. Is that clear to everybody? Yeah? Because they may not pair up. You may get an odd block, but that's easy to take care of. Let's just get the main idea, okay? So when we've parsed this entire disk, we have basically doubled the size of the sorted blocks. Maybe an odd one left at the end, but that's not really a problem. It will get taken care of as we merge more and more stuff together, okay? Now, when you've done this, of course, you now swap rows, input, output, double the size of sorted blocks, okay? All right, so there are two objections to this approach, okay? One is a practical performance one, and the other one is an absolute killer, right? Let's do the practical performance objection. Well, are you seriously going to pull in one item of data into main memory, glue them together and write them out and then pull another item out? Get real. Even this thing here has 4 gigabytes of memory, RAM, you know. It's the most I could put in it. Okay, so, you know. When I bought my desktop machine, a friend of mine had 4 gig in his one, so I thought, I'll get 8. You know. Unfortunately, I can't get more than 4 into this, otherwise I would. Okay. I don't know. Handy hint, when buying something, buy as high a spec as you can, that way it'll last longer. Yeah. Anyway. So that's it, you know. So would you seriously pull in one byte or whatever of stuff into this, another byte, sort them, write it out, another, you know, considering the cost of individual accesses to disk, stupid or what, right? So that's obviously not a starter. Well, that's easily remedied, of course. When we go back to our first situation of individual. So entirely unsorted as far as we know, okay? So now let's get real. We have our main memory, okay? The vertical thing is RAM in the computer. The horizontal thing is a file on disk, okay? Let's say we can hold K things in RAM, okay? We've left a bit of RAM for local variables, et cetera, okay? K is what we can pull in as data to work with, okay? Well, When you're going to look at this the first time round, why on earth are you wasting time putting in one item, so just pull in K items and sort them in main memory, for God's sake, right? Yeah. So the first time round, grab yourself K of these, put them into here, now call your favorite optimal sorting algorithm that works in main memory, right? And when that's finished, write it all out so you've got a block of size K sorted, yeah? That's a lot better than, you know, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Yeah, come on, yeah? So that issue is easily addressed, okay? That's not the killer. What's the killer issue? Exactly. After this first time round, you have to pull in 2 blocks to merge them together, right? Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, that alone would fill the main memory. So if you try and pull in the next block to merge them, well, you're sunk, right? That's the killer, okay, in terms of progress, all right? So how do we get around this? Very easily, actually, all right? Let's make the following observation. So let's take 2 blocks, size K, right? I can't pull them in there together at the same time. Let me split my memory into 3 parts, 3 equal parts. Doesn't have to be exactly equal, but might as well. Okay? I'll pull in K over 3 things from this block and fill this part. Okay? I'll pull in K over 3 things from this block and put them in this part. Okay? Now I've got this bit of RAM in which I can do my merging of these things. Obviously, I can't merge them entirely in main memory. I've only got K over 3, and there's 2 K over 3 items, right? Not a problem. I merge until this becomes full, in which case I pause. So I maintain pointers, so maybe my merge has got to this point here and perhaps to this point here when this has become full. What do I do when it becomes full? Well, I write it out to my write-out disk. So now this gets K over 3 things, which I know are correctly sorted as far as these two blocks are concerned, my current two blocks, yeah? Having suspended operations that way, I can now resume, because this is now empty, I can resume, right? If at any stage I have run out of entries in this block, but I still have entries in here, for example, not a problem, I just fetch in the next K over 3 things from here, right? I pause, bring the next K over 3, resume. Of course, I set my pointer now to the start of this. That one stays where it was before I paused, yeah? Clear? Well, obviously, in this way, I can merge these two blocks, no matter how big they are, using this careful apportioning of main memory, right? Clear? Anything difficult about that? I don't think so. I think it's very easy. It's a beautiful idea, very simple. You can vary, you know, why K over 3, K over 3, K over 3. Well, purely heuristically, you don't want to have to keep going to disk too often, so you'd like to pull in as much of this block as you can, but if you pulled in K amounts of it, then there's no space left for anything else, right? Likewise for this block, okay? But if you said, well, I'll assign K over 2 to that block, K over 2 to the other one, then where are you going to do your merging? You're going to have to keep writing them out to disk one at a time. That's going to slow you down, okay? So if you do it about equal amounts, essentially every time you visit a disk either to read or write, you're doing blocks of size K over 3, and K is going to be pretty huge. So every time you do a disk access, you are... making the most of it. You've got the head where it is, now you just say, zoom, okay? Better, yes? You might, as a matter of practicality, say, well, I'll pull 100 megabytes, and then use the rest, whatever, okay? It just depends on your setup. But that's a kind of reasonable, general notion. If you look at external merge sort, you find all kinds of versions of it, but they're all variations of this kind of idea, right? That you use... your main memory, a portion between the two blocks, when it gets full, write out, etc. Now, when you merge these two blocks, you do the next two, the next two, the next two, until you've run out. There may be an odd one left, in which case you just copy it back to the other disk, okay? And then you go back, you switch roles of the disks, this becomes input, this becomes output, and now you're dealing with sorted blocks of twice the size before, right? Okay, so how many times do you have to do this? Basically, log of the number of items in your external disk. Give or take, taking care of the fact that they may not be exactly a power of 2. But that's easily dealt with. Okay, so, apologies. That horrendous looking bit of pseudocode is nothing more than a rather careful description of this very simple idea. We've got the floors, etc., the ceilings, rather, and so on, to take account of the fact that the number of blocks may not be a power of 2, and so on. And that just takes account of this situation. But the main idea is as simple and as straightforward as that. And that is the thing to understand. Okay. Is that clear to everybody? Anything difficult about that? Anybody not clear about it so far? I want to reward you for making the effort to come here, you see, so I want to make sure you go away with an absolutely crystal clear idea of what external merge sort is. Everybody happy? Yeah? Brilliant. That's brilliant. Okay. In that case, if you want any more reading, there it is. Any questions? Yes.
So would the runtime of this be n log squared n?
No, it's n log n, but it's still n log n. But of course, the constants are a lot bigger than if you do it in main memory. Now, the runtime analysis is exactly as before, okay? Because you are doubling the size of the sorted block each time. Right? So you only do log n visits to this, and it takes n to do it, okay? So it's still the same runtime, but as I say, the constants are what you're concerned with here. Yeah. So our main concern would be to minimize the number of times we go to disk, the number of seeks we have to make to find where we should go. Okay. But thank you, yeah, that's a good point. Any other questions? Why don't we have an early break, 11 minutes early? Don't tell the boss, don't need to dock my pay. Okay? All right, thank you very much. See you next time.
Thank you. jump in.